For 2 weeks, I've been listening to participants discuss poems. First day, we did a set of poems on introduction to poetry. What is a poem, and what is a good way to read it to make it come clear? And the next day, we had some sessions on reading imagery, metaphor. And then after that, we had poems of nature, we had poems of God, and we had death poems. And then this week, we've had Robert Frost, Thomas Hardy, Gerard Manley Hopkins, Shakespeare, and women poets. And here we go for our second time with God poems. So I'm going to, and this is, my approach has been this, that the poems, too often I think in the schools, have been considered the province of scholars, that we need teachers, we need somebody who knows a poem well to explain it to the lesser folk. And I don't approve of that at all. And in the 32 years that I watch students in the classroom, I'm quite persuaded that they are going to have a more lasting experience with poetry because they were able to have some enjoyment in wrestling with the poems, thinking about them, discussing them. So, and I think that that's sound logic on my part, because as all art, a poem ought to be an experience. And one of the experiences of reading the poem is making it come clear that at first there's some kind of a stay of awareness that you just don't know exactly what's going on. But if you're going to discuss these poems, your involvement with them is going to be much more active and therefore going to be more interesting for you. Plus the fact that I see no reason why we can't take poetry that way, because it's not like some science or theology perhaps, where we want a scholar to help us, where there's a large body of knowledge in the whole field. But we don't have to do that with the poem. However, I think taking that attitude about a poem oftentimes gives people a notion that I don't hold, and that is that any reading is as good as another. I don't believe that's true. I think that if you turn me loose with a poem and say, all right, Roman, it's yours to deal with, I can be careless, and I can be indifferent to the language, and I can make that poem say anything to me that I want it to say. A lot of people treat a poem that way, that, well, the poem is for the individual, and so whatever I want it to mean, I can make it mean, and that's quite all right, and nobody can tell me, but I don't think so. I think we have an obligation, if we are honest with ourselves, and if we treat our minds as powerful things that can get at language and accurate language, I think we work hard with the poem to say, I know that I know that poem better than you. And that's the way I would like you to feel today, that not anything goes. I was trying to impress this on students long ago, back in 1964. I can remember the occasion very well. It's a poem that we used up here in the last couple of weeks from Archibald MacLeish, and it's called Ars Poetica, The Art of Poetry, in which he's saying, this is what a poem ought to be. And the students were discussing it. I don't tell them anything. I just ask questions and never give them my reading. And they couldn't resolve it. They were very upset with me and that I wouldn't help them. It was kind of early in the course. And I said, well, why don't you write to Archibald MacLeish, the poet? Never thinking that they would do it, nor that he would respond if they did.
He's still alive?
Nancy Moe and Mike Murphy, I can remember them so well. It's 1964. One day, Nancy Moe came into the class, and they used her address. She said, he wrote back! He wrote back! She had this letter from Archibald MacLeish. Isn't that marvelous? Little high school kids getting a letter from him. I think he was still at the Library of Congress at the time. I'm not sure. But anyhow, and it was so interesting because he didn't solve their problem for them. But he said, thank you for calling this problem to my attention. He said, I never quite thought about it the way you are, and I didn't see that it was a problem, but he said, I can see where it might be. He said, while I'm at it, he said, I want to remind you that, he said, you wrote to me for an answer. He said, I want you to understand, he said, that once the poem is given, the person who made the poem has no more right to say what's on that page than the person who really reads it. And that's really very sound, you see, because all that's on the page is the language. And if we, and he said, that means taking into consideration diction and syntax and image and rhythm and idea, all of that. And his point is sound, because if we really read the fullness of the poem on the page, that makes us as much right about it as the person who wrote it, because he might only have something in his head that he didn't get on the page. See? So that's why he said that. You're as much a part of it as I am. So, well, we'll look at some of these together, but we probably can read through all of them. And then, so we want to go. Let's start on page 14, right? Hap. This is Thomas Hardy. If but some vengeful God would call to me from up the sky and laugh, thou suffering thing, know that thy soul is my ecstasy, that thy love's loss is my hate's profiting. Then would I bear it, clench myself, and die, steeled by the sense of ire unmerited, half eased in that a powerfuler than I had willed and meted me the tears I shed. But not so. How arise it joy lies slain, and why unblooms the best hope ever sown? Crass casualty obstructs the sun and rain, and dicing time for gladness casts a moan. These purblind doomsters had as readily strown blisses about my pilgrimage as pain. Thomas Hardy died the year I was born, and you may guess. Batter my heart, three-personed God. John Donne, this is. John Donne was a contemporary of Shakespeare. Shakespeare died in 1616. John Donne died in 1631, I believe. I haven't checked those dates lately. Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend. That I may rise and stand or throw me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another due, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captive, and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. The poet. Someone want to read the poet?
Okay.
Good.
When God at first made man, having a glass of blessing standing by, let us, said he, pour on him all we can, let the world's riches which dispersed lie contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty flowed, then wisdom, honor, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure rest in the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature. So both should losers be. Yet let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least, if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast.
Thank you. Here's another one from Hardy. You want to read that one?
I'll read it.
Thank you.
God's education. I saw him steal the light away that haunted in her eye. It wept so gently none could say more than that it was there one day, and missing by and by. I watched her longer, and he stole her lily pinks and rose. All her young spirit sprightliness of soul next fell beneath his cold control and disappeared like those. I asked, why do you serve her soul? Do you for some glad day hoard these were sweets? He said, oh no. They claim they charm not me. I bid time throw them carelessly away. Said I, we call that cruelty, we your poor mortal kind. He mused, the thought is new to me. Forsooth, though I men's master be, theirs is the teaching mind.
Thank you. There should be a quotation marks in the third last line, mm-hmm. right after muse, in front of the thought. Okay. Redemption, anybody?
Is that the top one? Redemption?
Sure, please.
Having been tenant long to a rich lord, not thriving, I resolved to be bold and make a suit unto him to afford a new small rented lease and cancel the old. In heaven at his manor I him sought. They told me there that he was lately gone about some land which he had dearly bought, long since on earth to take possession. I straight returned, and knowing his great birth, sought him accordingly in great resorts, in cities, theatres, gardens, parks, and courts. At length I heard a ragged noise and mirth of thieves and murderers. There I him espied, who straight your suit is granted, said, and died.
The little vagabond. Dear mother, the church is cold, but the alehouse is healthy and pleasant and warm. Besides, I can tell where I am used well. Such usage in heaven will never do well. But if at the church they would give us some ale and a pleasant fire our souls to regale, we'd sing and we'd pray all the livelong day, nor ever once wish from the church to stray. Then the parson might preach and drink and sing, and we'd be as happy as birds in the spring. And modest Dame Lurch, who is always at church, would not have bandy children, nor fasting, nor birch. And God, like a father rejoicing to see his children as pleasant and happy as he, would have no more quarrel with the devil or the barrel, but kiss him and give him both drink and apparel. A little one from Robert Frost there. Forgive me, Lord. Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. Somebody want to read the Edward Taylor piece, Meditation on it. Canticle. Thank you.
Am I thy gold or purse, Lord, for thy wealth, whether in mine or mint refined for thee? I'm counted soul, but count me o'er thyself, lest gold-washed face in a brass heart I be. I fear my touchstone touches when I try me, and my counter gold too over me. Am I new minted by thy stamp indeed? Mine eyes are dim, I cannot clearly see. Be thou my spectacles that I may read thine image and inscription stamped on me. If thy bright image do upon me stand, I am a golden angel in thy hand. Lord, make my soul thy plate, thine image bright within the circle of the same in foil, and on its brims in golden letters write thy superscription in an holy style. Then I shall be thy money, thou my hoard. Let me thy angel be thou my Lord.
Okay. We're going to reassemble, regroup into groups of three or four, and I'd like you to study closely the John Donne piece, Batter My Heart, and the George Herbert right underneath it, the pulley. Okay, and if you lose interest or exhaust the possibilities of those, take a close look at Hap. All right, but let's, and then when we get together, we'll you can discuss in those small groups for probably about 20 minutes. That'll leave us 20 minutes to get together for a large group where we can resolve some questions that were unanswered.
Would you go over those three different ones?
Yes, on page 14,
yes.
The one on the left side, Batter My Heart,
that one,
and the one right below it, the pulley. Those two, especially study those, And we'll consider them in relation to each other. And then if we have time, we'll look at Hap. So, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, we've got two groups of four and one of three. Can we do that? And if you would just move your chairs close so your tete-a-tete, you'll be able to.
Do you have a question for us?
I do, but I think I won't give it right now, okay? I'll let you maybe form some questions, okay? Which of these two poets expresses the better theology as far as you're concerned, Donne or Herbert? They were contemporaries. Donne died in 1631 and Herbert in 1633. I just checked Herbert. I didn't remember his date. By that I mean this, that if you were restricted to taking this person's view of God, which of course is very singular and not full in any sense, but you just got, each one makes a single statement about God. I want you to select the one that would be most palatable for you, either Donne's or Herbert's. And that is the view of God that you would be able to use if you wanted to teach something about God. And you could use no more than that. You could just use that view that one or the other has. Now, I'll read the two poems through again so you can be thinking about that when we go through them. Well, any question about that? Okay, here we go. Batter my heart, three-person to God. Batter my heart, three-person to God, for you as yet knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another due, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me should defend, but is captive and proved weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me. The pulley. When God at first made man, having a glass of blessing standing by, let us, said he, pour on him all we can. Let the world's riches, which dispersed lie, contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty flowed, then wisdom, honor, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made us stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure, rest in the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature, so both should losers be. Yet let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least, if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. Okay, yeah. Understand the question?
Yeah.
Okay, now to keep you honest, we have to vote blindfolded. Otherwise, you might say, well, everybody votes the other way and I'll go with them, even though I know I'm right, but I'm not going to say so. Okay, so I want you to close your eyes when I ask you to show your hand, or everybody close your eyes so you can see others vote. Okay, how many say that the first one, Batter My Heart, expresses the better theology that you would prefer if you were going to, you people hold up your hands. Okay, thank you. And how many say that the George Herbert, the pulley, is the better? Thank you. Well, you didn't agree. So get it settled. Would you like to know who voted how? Would you like to know that?
Just
the number.
How many voted?
Three voted for Batter My Heart, and I guess nine, I think there are 12 of you, voted for the pulley. And since the people who voted for the pulley, you have the bigger task, the harder task, because you've got so many and your group is so cumbersome, you know, you can't get your ideas together quickly, you can go first. And whoever wants to speak, defend your position. Why?
Why I voted for the pulling?
You bet.
My view of this poem is that we have a loving God who bestows on us all these blessings, and he holds back the one that...
Excuse me, we're going to let two other people come in. This is God of ones, right? That's right. Come into the circle. We're looking at, on page 14, two poems, the one in the middle on the left-hand side, Batter My Heart, Three Persons God, and The Pulley, right below it. And the question is, which of those expresses the better theology? If you had to choose one, which would you take if you had to use that theology to teach about God? And that's all you could use, what that poem expresses. Go ahead. And we're just beginning the argument.
Yeah. The way I look at this poem and what it means to me is that God has made man with all the blessings, but God is, in all his knowledge, knows that he has to pull back something because man has to reach for God too. If God had given everything to man, maybe man would say, well, I don't need any God. I can worship God in nature, you know, and so I'm self-sufficient now. But God, being wise, pulls that back, and it says he won't let him, you know, rest. He keeps pricking at him that there is a need, and you can liken it maybe to a your conscious, you know, voice that says, well, I better do what's right, what's good, and that. And it says that in spite of all the goodness, you know, that can bring people to God, that sometimes in weariness, you keep nagging, but then they'll go to God too. And that's what I got out of the poem, and why I thought that it's better than what I got out of the other one, because that isn't the loving God.
Glad we got that settled. Go ahead. Yeah, don't wait for me. I'll be here only if you start fighting too strong, and then I'll ring a bell or something, and the fire alarm.
The first one, Batter My Heart, to me, seemed to be more about the person writing the poem than about God. And so if I needed to have something to use to teach about God, then it seemed to me that was included more in the second poem. It described more what God was like. The first poem described more what the man was like.
Does the first poem, the Donne poem, does it express a viewpoint about the nature of God? Does anybody see if that's in there?
Oh, it certainly does. Yes. It does yes. That.
What? Go ahead. What does it say?
It expresses
what kind of a God
that,
is he?
That God is definitely a God of love, but that this person has rejected everything, no matter what God has tried to do. And he says, yet dearly I love you, and he would, the man says, he, in spite of all of this, but he's so, and you know, so taken by the enemy of God, the devil, that he just can't pull himself out of it and accept the love of God. That's the way it appears to me.
But that's why I liked it, because I can identify with that, and the only thing I know about God, I know from my human experience, and I feel sometimes like that, like I shut the door, but I want God to batter it down.
Yes.
And it's a lot easier for me to identify with that than to identify with a perspective on the world from God's side. So I like the Donne, that's why I voted for the Donne poem.
Well, I voted just the opposite because... I I feel that if we're going to encourage and try to help other people, we want to, well, we want to bring out the loving kindness of God, and I don't know how to express myself, I guess.
Is God more kind and loving in one of these poems than he is in the other?
Yes, I feel...
Which one?
I feel that God is, in the first one, we have a perfect picture of God.
What is the attribute of God that you find in the second one? You were going to say something.
The attribute of God in the second one, well, he did. He gave us everything except rest. And humans are restless.
Do you find him a less loving God in the second one than in the first one? You said that you chose he was a loving God.
My feeling is that it shows us the weakness of man so badly in the first one.
And I'm going to still ask my question, because you made your choice on the basis of more loving God, right?
Yes.
So is he a less loving God in the second one?
No. Okay. I think that God is, in the first one, I mean in the second one, is a more loving God. He's given us everything except rest. And he man is restless and searching and working and so forth for God. And that's why I like the second one. That's what I'd like to teach anyone else that I had to teach.
Here comes an argument. Go ahead. Well, I thought you were leaning over to respond to her. Anybody, go ahead.
Okay.
Good.
Well, this seems so human. I voted for that in my heart, because it just seems that it speaks to me so well. I think you mentioned that. We were in the same group. Maybe that's why we got the same thing. But that we're so overcome with sin in our world, and it's a constant plea with God to, you have to work at it. It's a hard knock world, but we've got to keep knocking on the door. So it's a perpetual kind of thing to me. But I love you. I love you. And I know that you can do it, but you've got to keep working on it.
I think you're right. I'd go with a loving God. She said it all. To me, it seems that he's given us all these riches. And if he also gave us rest, then we wouldn't. He's left out one thing so that you can get weary with working, and you do get restless. So if you're not going to be good, or you are not good enough for God, at least weariness may take you to Him.
So you like that view of God?
She said, "Oh yeah. I don't think you're wrong. No better."
I
one's coming at it from one way, through man, the first one. And the next one, it seems to me that God is telling you more about himself.
In the pulley, the third stanza, the last line, "So both should losers be." Who are the two?
Nature and God.
Who?
God and man.
Does God need us?
Yes,
sure
he
does.
Sure he does, because he loves us. And he wouldn't have made man if he didn't need us.
He needs us.
Do you agree that God is a loser if I fail?
Yes.
Yes.
Does anybody disagree with that?
No, I believe that.
Yes, you do.
It's just like you love your own, taking it down to the human side. You're a loser if your children fail.
Is God perfect?
Yes.
Can a perfection have a need?
Oh, well, now that's a new one. I suppose they do.
A perfection is lacking something?
Well, Jesus was God, and he certainly had a need, and he expressed it. And he even had such a need when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane that he said, "Let this cup be taken away from me." But he accepted it. So he had a need.
A perfection wouldn't be a perfection unless it had everything, because to be perfected, you have to be well-rounded and you have to have everything right. And so God would need us to be perfect.
Did you say a perfection can't be a perfection if it has everything?
No, it has to have a well-balanced, well-rounding of everything, because if it doesn't, then it loses its perfection. It's no longer in balance. So God would need to have us to make it a well-balanced, perfected being.
So if a being is perfect, is it lacking anything?
It's lacking love. Your love and your praise and your adoration.
So something can be perfect and still be lacking something.
Because that's what God expects from his children.
Do you all agree with that?
At the present stage, we're not perfect. It would take an awful lot of refining as long as we're still as human as we are.
I don't say we're perfect. I say God is perfect.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And God expects us to be perfect. He accepts us as we are.
But we strive to be more like him. I know someone that really wants everything lined up, you know, just perfect, and everything to happen perfectly. And when it doesn't, he is just torn apart.
And this is the way God is.
Yes.
You like that notion of God?
I think it's an abstract.
The torn apart God? What?
I think it's a very abstract thought.
You what?
I think it's a very abstract thought. Mm-hmm. That God is perfect but needs.
We'd like to think of God as being perfect, and I think God is sorrowful when we do not act perfectly.
Well, I think God made his creation to enjoy all of it. I think he was lonely. And he created his creation for his enjoyment.
So he does need it.
And if it hadn't happened, you know, the Garden of Eden and sin, the world would be in harmony as God had created it.
I wrote a poem once which was about God, and it said God, after he did all this, was weary and he took a nap, and while he was napping, some evil crept into the world.
The evil was in the world before God ever made the world. I mean, because
did you say
Satan,
if or did you say it was?
Satan is a fallen angel, isn't he?
I wasn't there.
Isn't that what it says in the Bible?
Before
Lucifer was thrown out of heaven, it says in the Bible.
Well, but I go back to the creation story. And it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and so on. It was good. I think that man, maybe we're the devils. We do the things that make our hell.
Was God more perfect before humans?
Well, I never think of God before humans. I mean, he's been since
always. Yeah.
Okay, so was God...
Well,
did God have existence before humans did?
According to our biblical story.
And I wonder what your mind says.
Well, you know, God is within me.
And you're changing the subject on me, too. I wonder what it, if, was God, did God have existence before humans did?
Yes, well, according to the biblical story.
Was he more perfect before he created humans?
I wrestle with that word, more perfect. It's like being honest.
Look, perfect.
Can you be
right?
I got myself in trouble.
It's better to say he was without. You know, it's without sin.
But he's
sinless.
You can't be a little bit pregnant.
Yeah.
Go ahead. We'll let you go. Stay with it.
I got myself in a little bit of trouble because the lady said.
she was talking about her children. They could never get into politics because he's more honest. And I thought, if you're honest, can you be more honest? You can be less honest. Can you be more or less honest?
Well, you can't be more than perfectly honest because
yeah,
that's
so
it.
There I say, yeah. Can it be more perfect?
Well,
Perfect is perfect.
I asked the question before because someone said that God's imperfection resulted from imperfect humans.
Yeah.
So my logic was this. If God's perfection was somewhat tainted by human beings, was God more perfect before we had human beings?
Well, I like to flat out from the idea that God is love. And to my human mind, love involves vulnerability. And Jesus used the parable of there's greater rejoicing in the finding of the one lost sheep, or that whole thing, than in the 99. And so the idea that there is rejoicing, I don't know if that had anything to do with perfect or more perfect, but there is rejoicing when there's unity, when we're all together. And in love, if you love someone, you really open yourself up to a lot of vulnerability. And it seems to me when God created people, God became vulnerable.
Okay.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Because I think, I agree with you, I think this discussion is abstract, and I get tired of that kind of stuff because in a sense it's not relevant. That's very relevant and true to experience. And that's why I like Dunn better, because it's so close to experience. And it includes sin. The other one doesn't.
It did what?
It includes the reality of sin and the sense of being estranged from God. And the other one doesn't. I mean, you can be restless and not be a restlessness that has anything to do with sin. And so Dunn is just much closer to my world.
We talked about the idea of the poi, and it's really sort of a single track.
Yeah.
You know, either you're weary or you're not weary. I mean, and sort of between man and God, whereas this other one is quite not a single track at all. I mean, he's all over the place. He's so passionate.
Yeah.
So that you...
Well, you're a risk taker if you take a group of sheep out and let them wander around. God is a risk taker. He turns us loose as sheep.
Free will?
Right. And... something can happen to that sheep out there, all around this area. And he's joyous when that sheep is recovered, but he really is weeping when one is lost.
How do you like the image in the last line of Dunn? He will only become chaste if he is ravished. Is that the usual way?
Well, I don't like it, but I see what he means. And he was so passionate that he'd had to be all or nothing for him.
Is it apt that someone could be chastened by being ravished? If it's a divine being?
Well, I think in this case he means if he can't accept the three, why he's...
Well, it's time to go. Did anybody change her or his mind?
I don't know what
this
you
discussion?
Had on me, but if you think, I think Herbert sounds cynical.